the class is a sensitive visit is more than caring. And usually I teach a class on grief, which I've done the last 3 years that we've been here. And then when I got the Holden newspaper from spring of 1993, I read Scott Hathrood's opening article and changed my mind about what I was going to teach after having read this article. I'm going to read you four sentences. These are the four significant sentences that I read. Everyone longs to tell her or his story to someone and have it understood and accepted. Human beings are one of the sacred, fragile, and mysterious creations of God, and there is probably no service we can render to one another that is more important than to be a listener to another when they are in need to open their hearts and tell their story. It is the conversation that continues with the knowledge that we will be listened to deeply and attentively, and that the other person will try and walk in our shoes. What does it mean to listen to the sacred, and what will we learn? After reading this article, I decided that's what I wanted to do instead of the grief talk. I'm a hospital chaplain, as you may have read, in St. Luke's Hospital in Davenport, Iowa. And I have the privilege of listening to the stories of people who are sick, who are facing an operation, and who are dying. And 2 years ago, my church is St. Paul's Lutheran Church, and we have a caregivers workshop in January, and we have a lot of people in our community that have been trained as Stevens ministers. How many of you know what Stevens ministers are? Okay, good. And have been trained as befrienders, and our hospital is the one that trains befrienders, and it's like Stevens ministers. They are lay people who are trained for 28 weeks to go into a hospital room and to befriend the person who's in the hospital and allow them to share their story, how they feel about what's going on in their lives. Well, this workshop is done at St. Paul's, and there's a head speaker, and then there's seven mini workshops. And I was asked to do a nuts and bolts type mini session on how to do a successful visit. And they thought I was kind of a nuts and bolts person. I didn't know if that was a compliment or not. But I decided it was, and so I went with it as a compliment. And so, but I thought, you know, these are trained people. You know, I can't imagine what I'm going to do that's new and different. And I kind of envisioned about 11 people sitting in a little semicircle and talking about our experiences. Well, a week before the workshop began, I asked the director, now I have handouts, so how many should I have ready for? And usually between 200 and 250 people come to this workshop. And she said, well, you have 72 in the morning and 80 in the afternoon. And I just about flipped. I had no idea that many people would be coming to this session. So I changed the whole format of the session, and you're going to get what I did for that session. But when I thought about it afterwards, I understood the why of it. No matter who we are, if we're trained, how many of you have been trained as a Stevens minister? Okay. No matter if we're trained as a Stevens minister, or as a hospital chaplain, or as a clergy with 4 years, any clergy in here? 4 years of training in seminary, or we're trained as a hospice befriender, or a befriender in the hospital as a layperson. When we make a cold call on someone, when we're asked to go to the hospital and visit someone, or we know someone who has just found out that they have cancer, or we have to go to the nursing home because our church wants us to go visit so-and-so, it's those butterflies. It's like, oh my goodness, I don't know this person. A cold call, I mean, you don't know the person. You've never been there before. I don't know this person. Are they going to like me? Am I going to like them? What are they going to ask me to do? Do they want me to pray with them? Oh my goodness. And sometimes you can feel yourself walking toward that call and thinking, gee, I kind of wish that I had just kind of made a loaf of bread and I could go up to them and say, hi, how you doing? And hopefully they'll say, just fine. And I'll say, great, here, I brought you a loaf of bread. I'm glad you're doing fine. I could leave, you know, because it's scary wondering what you're going to find when you walk through that door. And when I realized all that, I realized why 100 and some people showed up for that morning and afternoon session about a sensitive visit is more than caring. So it's when I prayed about this session today, and when I prayed about it, when I put it together, I said, if each of you can take away one thing that will help you move into caregiving and making visits on people, that is my prayer for you, is that you can take away at least one thing. So that's why the title also is, A Sensitive Visit is More Than Caring. Anyone who makes these calls is already caring, or you wouldn't be doing it. But it's the sensitivity part, having those antennas up, those feelers up, to know what this person needs. And when I put this together, I thought about three pathetic incidences and stories of people who had made calls and been really insensitive. And that's what I'm going to start out with. The first one was a trained lay minister who was a widow. And she was calling on a friend of hers who had 6 weeks to 2 months ago become widowed. And she called her up and said she was going to be coming to make this visit. She arrived, and not too long into the conversation, she said to her newly widowed friend, "You know, you've lost your identity now." This person said, "What do you mean, I have lost my identity now?" Already you can hear the perturbedness in her voice. She said, "Well, you used to be Mrs. John Smith, and you're not Mrs. John Smith anymore. You've lost that." And this person kind of sat up and said, "From the day of my wedding, I was Mary Smith, and I will continue to be Mary Smith, and I have not lost that identity." This lay minister went caring. But what did she go with that she should have left at home? Her own agenda. "I'm going to go and help you out. I'm going to tell you what the pitfalls of being a widow are, because I know them, and if I tell you about the problems, I'll be helping you out and pulling you through on the other end to make it easier for you." This woman didn't want to be told what the pitfalls of being a widow were. She went caring, but she didn't go sensitive. The second story is about a hospital caller, and I regret to say he was trained by our department. Poorly, I might add. In our hospital, we have befrienders that come daily to make calls. And we give them cards of various patients on various floors. And they go up and they go into the room and negotiate a visit with whoever is there. This was a gentleman, and he went up to the cancer floor. And he negotiated his visit, sat down, and asked the patient why she was here at the hospital. And I want you to listen to the verbs in this sentence. The patient said, "I had cancer, but I just had a mastectomy." Before she could continue with this sentence or this story, we'll never know what she would have said, this caller said, "That's just what my wife died from." He never did get it. He never did quite understand what it meant to be sensitive. Needless to say, we got a call from the patient, and we got a call from the nurse who had to calm down this rather irate patient, and she had a right to be. Like I said, this person isn't making calls for us anymore. The third story, I have been a chaplain for Candlelighters, which is a support group for parents whose children have cancer, for 6 years. And unfortunately, in those 6 years, we had several children die. And I was at a visitation in a funeral home, and standing in front of me was a lady going through the line, and the casket is there, and this 14-year-old little Nancy is in the casket, and she's just died of cancer, and her mother and her little brother are standing next to the casket. And the lady in front of me goes through, and I hear this conversation. She said, "Nancy was the very best, the best child that could ever be. The sweetest child ever. There was no child like her. No one could compare with her. And you know, God only takes, what am I going to say, the best." You know, he must have needed another little angel in heaven. Think of what I just said from the perspective of the little 11-year-old brother who is standing right there, listening to the conversation between mom and mom's, quote, friend. Nancy was the very best. What does this little do to little Joey who's standing here? Oh my gosh, Nancy was the best, the very best. Where does that leave me? Well, she must have considered me at second best at best, and maybe farther down the list than that. What's the next thing he could have said, what he might have thought? God only takes the best. Now, consciously or unconsciously, what's little Joey, whatever I called him before, going to be like from now on?
If I want to survive, I'm not going to be very good.
I'm not going to be very good. I'm going to be a little hellion, because if this is what happened to my sister, because she was the best, then, and Mom would say, gee, I don't know what will happen to him, but after Nancy died, he just became uncontrollable. Well, consciously or unconsciously, if God takes the best, I don't want to be that. And the next thing is, this lady shared her theological reflections of why children died. God must have needed another little angel in heaven. I would venture to say that cliches are the last things that we want to share at a funeral home or a visitation. This is kind of an aside. But cliches don't make it. No matter what we say, it may not fit with the philosophy or the theology of what that person is going through and what the reasoning they have for this death. So this woman, I'm sure, came to be comforting, but it definitely wasn't going to be comforting for this little boy. So tonight what we're going to do is hopefully augment our skills on being attentive and sensitive to the pains and the needs of those that we go and visit. So I'm going to ask you to use your imagination. You know, you walk into a class and you don't really know what you're in for, right? And you kind of become the guinea pigs of the class that you've gone into. So unfortunately, you're going to have to do this little exercise. But I think it's going to be helpful. The first time I did it, or something similar to it, and I just adapted it to this, I had a lump in my throat. What I'm going to ask you to do in a few minutes is to close your eyes, get comfortable. You know it's coming when somebody says that, right? Oh, gosh. And imagine what I'm going to ask you to walk through. I'm going to ask you in a few minutes to picture yourself old. I'm going to ask you to picture yourself with a chronic illness. I'm going to ask you to picture yourself having lost a significant person and going through an experience where a visitor comes to call on you. In this condition, and I'm going to have you have a conversation with this person. And I had never envisioned myself old or having a chronic illness. So because most of us, some of us, don't have chronic illnesses or don't consider ourselves in the older generation yet, we have to use our imaginations to know what it's like to call on the people that we're going to call on. And I think it makes us more sensitive. So if you close your eyes and get comfortable, I think this will be helpful. You are standing in front of a mirror. You look in the mirror and you see yourself as old. You choose how old that is. You look at your hair, you look at your skin, and you look at the clothes that you have on. Now you look about the place that you're in. You picture yourself either in a home, your home, an apartment, a nursing home, or a hospital, and see that room. Now picture yourself walking over and sitting or lying down somewhere in that room and watch how you move. You look around at the things, the belongings that surround you in that room. You notice the things that are present and you notice what things might be absent. Now you recall the face of the loved one that has just recently died. You determine who that loved one is. And you feel the pain, the grief, the loneliness of that absence, and how that affects your life right now. And then you think not only of that, but you are reminded as you sit there of the chronic illness that you must cope with daily and how that illness affects your life. You choose what chronic illness
you have. There's a knock at the door, and a visitor comes to see you. You choose who that is and whether you know the person or you don't know the person. Now you're going to let the conversation between the two of you play out. What does that caller ask or say? How do you respond? And I'm going to give you a minute and a half of silence to have that significant conversation in your mind and how you feel about it in your heart. Now the visitor is going to leave. Listen to how he or she negotiates that departure. And you are alone again in your room with the memories and the feelings of that visit. As you sit there, recognize how you feel about it, how you reacted to that visit and visitor and the conversation. Okay, hopefully we were able to use our imaginations to become somebody that we aren't, but somebody who we might be calling on. This is part of the discussion part now. In all of our Holden classes, we like to leave time for discussion, and this is part of the time we want to leave for discussion. I would like you to share what you learned in that little exercise. I don't want you to tell your whole experience, because with this many people, that doesn't work for a factor of time. But share with us what it felt like to be old, what it felt like to have a chronic illness, what it felt like to be in grief. Share with us what you felt as someone who's being called on, what you wanted to have happen that didn't happen, what did happen that you really liked, what you wished for, what you got angry at, what was helpful, what was not helpful. Whatever light bulb experience you feel like you had in those few minutes, I would love it if you would share that. And this is kind of the jumping off place of the rest of what we're going to do today. So I really need to hear what you have to say. Anybody get a lump? Want to tell us about it?
Yeah, I kind of relived the...
Now we need to talk loud enough that everybody can hear.
I kind of relived the visit with my husband's aunt that we had last week. And I put myself in her position. And I told her that we were going away for a week on vacation. And it left me really sad. Because I remembered all the vacations I had. Silly. Just in my imagination, I thought, gosh, you know, that isn't the right thing to do at all. To tell somebody to go on vacation.
If she was being left behind and couldn't go. And she depends on you, perhaps.
Yeah.
And she can't do those things anymore.
No, but how do you... I thought it was good to be cheerful and bring her the world, you know.
Yes. And when you come back, you can recount what you did. Will that bring her joy, or will that make her feel like, I didn't get to do those things?
Yeah, or I think the sadness of all those things you did together when you had your loved ones. You can't do that.
You can't do anymore. Those are just memories now.
Yeah, what do you do? I mean, but what do you talk to them about? I mean, I didn't have anything to talk to this person about because I'd been lying here with my illness.
What was your illness?
I have a little back trouble now. I was envisaging myself with an old lady. I probably could have terrible back trouble. So, you know.
And that inhibits you from doing the things that obviously we do at home.
Yeah,
we can't do those things. We'll talk about what you do.
Yeah.
And if we don't answer that, bring the question back.
Yeah.
Good. Thank you. What else? What'd you learn? I have a tissue.
I learned that I was angry and very discouraged when the visitor left, because the visitor was my son, who was giving me advice rather than listening to me. I mean, as a little girl, I hated hearing advice. As an adult, I hate hearing advice come out of my own mouth. So as an old lady, I sure didn't want advice from my kid.
No.
He was telling me, you know, how I should manage my affairs and how I should feel. And I was just furious.
What did you do with this anger? Did you tell him, I don't need your advice, or you just hold it in and say,
I was too sick to stand up for myself. I was real afraid.
So you just let it go, but it hurt you.
Okay.
Thank you for sharing the anger, because sometimes that's harder to share. And that was a very significant story. Thank you. What else?
I learned that touch was very important.
Tell us about that.
Well, I envisioned myself with my son, and he brought his family. Of course, we have a family. And he just shared his life, and all the little kids were there, and they touched me.
They hugged you, they held your hand.
Yep.
And how important that is for older people. And how sometimes hesitant we are to do that, you know. How hesitant we are to touch someone. And some people don't want us to touch. I remember the first time I hugged my father-in-law, he turned like this and he became absolutely wooden. I had to work really hard on my father-in-law. But that's when the antennas are needed, right? Does this person want me into their space, or don't they want me into their space? Can I touch them? You know, can I shake their hand? Can I put my hand on them? Can I give them a hug? You know, how much are they willing to let me get into their space? Thank you. That's good. Touch. Good topic. What else? Yeah.
I may share one. I don't know if this fits in this or not. So being myself, being an amputee, at the time of the accident, I didn't really want visitors.
You didn't want visitors?
And if they did come, stay 10 seconds and leave.
Okay. Come visit me, stay 10 seconds, but...
And I didn't want very many. I couldn't handle it.
Because you were in pain, because you didn't want to talk about it, because you didn't want to entertain them, why didn't you want them there more than 10 seconds?
I think when you're an amputee, you don't have the energy to handle people coming to visit.
Okay.
That was my case.
So this is a hospital visit?
In the hospital for 12 days.
12 days. I think you brought up a great point. Those antennas have to be up, because we got to know how long we can stay. And if they're sick, had an operation yesterday, had a leg cut off yesterday, are throwing up, you know, whatever, we better know to stay 10 seconds rather than 25 minutes.
It's very tiring.
One of the things, if your visitor had said to you, what's your first name?
Norm.
Pardon?
Norm.
Norm. Norm, I sense that you're not feeling well today. Would it be best for me, you know, to come back in a couple days and you're feeling better? Would you have liked that, and would you have respected that if they had just come right out and asked you how long they could stay?
Well, in this case, I amputated 4 fingers.
Oh, it was fingers. Okay.
And they were replanted. And for 12 days, I really didn't want anybody around except my own wife.
Mm-hmm. And this sounds like a sexist statement, but
sure.
More men say that than women.
No, I'm not saying this in any kind of sexist relationship.
I am saying.
Wait a minute, what are you saying?
I'm saying that more men are uncomfortable with longer visits than many times women are.
Oh, okay, that may be the case. But I know in my case, laying there for 12 days, I'm not even sure if I would want that person, if that person had come in, spent 10 seconds, I'm not sure if I would want that person to come back 2-3 days later.
Okay. And would you feel comfortable saying, you know, visit me at home or send me a card or just give me a call? I'm really not feeling up to this.
Let me say this. When you're in that state, you don't even feel like saying anything.
So did you give your wife the job to be the guard at the door?
I think I did.
I think
she might have relayed this message to friends of
hers.
Okay. So I was 120 miles away from home, being taken care of, so there wasn't a case of local friends could really just drop in to look at you.
To add to what you said.
But I think I would like that here. If I had been in a local hospital.
Been different.
Where your local friends could very easily have come in. I think we should be very, very sensitive. Maybe I'm blowing it out of proportion, but if I had been in a local hospital, I still would not want it. I think I would, I'm gonna clarify this a little bit more. I think I would want a pastor.
Why?
To come in and just say a prayer for me.
Okay. Say a prayer, and then don't expect me to talk. In situations like this, if we're making visits, sometimes it's not the patient, but it's that significant other who really needs to talk. It's the wife who sees the husband going through this, who says, who really needs somebody to say, hey, let me take you down and buy you a cup of coffee and let's talk. Because she's the one who really feels like, oh my gosh, I gotta share how I feel about this. This is an exhausting experience, you know. So sometimes it's not the person we go to visit that we end up ministering to. It's that other person. What else? Who else has a feeling of?
I want to share something that I experienced, because the first people that spoke here, they were visited by a friend, someone that they already knew.
Mm-hmm.
Whether subconsciously or what, you gave me the option of choosing someone whom I did not know.
Right. Oh, right.
And I think back of my mind is, I'm in retirement now, and I'm really thinking about getting involved with the hospice movement.
Ooh, good.
All right. So I went through this experience, and the person was delightful, and you know, did not offend in any way, inquired about how I was, wanted to know something about my spouse who had just died some time back, and family and so forth. But I felt that this person was here with a sense of duty.
Mm.
Why was this person here? Whereas if that had been a friend, someone that I already knew, I think I would have felt very differently. And I felt it was gracious, but somehow or other it just didn't fulfill me the same way it would have been had that been someone from my own congregation or friend who had stopped in. And I find that very troublesome, can you help me out?
Was there something about this person that didn't seem genuine?
No, not really.
Okay.
It's just that.
But you
questioned
there.
There was a stranger coming to see me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, let me share something. As a hospital chaplain, almost all the calls I make are cold calls. I don't know the people.
Yeah.
And when I took my first training as a befriender and then took my training as a chaplain, I was amazed. I was dumbfounded at the calls that I would walk into, never having met the person, and they would tell me their life story. Because they were at a point of crisis in their life. They were having lots of feelings they never had before. They may have been scared. And they may have been protecting the people in their own family. They would tell me stuff that they wouldn't tell their significant other or their spouse, because they wouldn't want that person to know how awful they really felt. But they would tell a total stranger because they knew I was a safe person. They knew that they may never see me again, or they knew that they might see me again and that they could trust me with the knowledge and the information that they gave me. I was amazed.
But they also knew you were a chaplain.
They
yes.
did.
Yeah.
But,
a big difference,
but,
I think.
But the befrienders that we train, they're folks just like you who just say, you know, I want to do this. They put on their little yellow smocks, or the gentleman just put on their name tags, and they walk in and they say, hi, I'm so-and-so from the befrienders. I'm a befriender. I'm from the chaplain's office. I'd just like to know if you'd like to visit today. Some of them, of course, don't. Some of them are too sick. Some of them wouldn't think of talking to somebody they didn't know. But boy, are there a whole lot of people who do. But it's the situation, too. You know, what's the situation that they're in right now? And some of, you know, I worked here and I'm retired from there and I have three kids, and some of them are going to get down to what I'm going to call later the sacred stories and share those. So it depends.
Mm-hmm.
I'd encourage you to become a volunteer in hospice. It's a great experience. I was a hospice chaplain for a while too, and it's great. What else? Who else learned something? Light bulb went on. Lump in your throat when something happened. You guys don't talk, I will. So it's your choice here. Yeah, yes.
I was quite old and frail and had broken a hip and was actively dealing with that, and also knowing that I probably didn't have a heck of a lot of time left. And my son came to visit, and I felt like I needed I need to offer to do something, like we can go for a walk. And I thought, no, I can't do that because my hip is bad. And then I thought, well, I can offer him some chocolate chip cookies. And then, no, I can't do that because I don't have the energy because my hip is bad. And the laundry is sitting there getting bad. And then I got real angry about having the disability. And then I turned it that, you know, that he's just there on duty. And so that duty thing came in, and I started feeling real uncomfortable about that. And when he left, which was real soon because I obviously was pretty cranky, then I just thought, I don't want to see him again.
This is too painful. Mm-hmm. There's too many things I can't do anymore, and this is so painful, I'd rather not have the experience than have to face all these things I can't mm-hmm. do. Think about that. The difficult calls, especially when we make them at nursing homes, which I don't do very often. When we see these people who are cranky, who don't want to talk, who are angry, the stories behind that, of why they're that way, I think it's harder sometimes to have that visitor, somebody you know, because you have so much history. One of the things I love to do with patients that I have trouble talking with, or have all these kind of bad things happen to them, and a tool that you can use is getting them, or with an older aunt, is to get them to reminisce. If you're going to visit somebody and, gee, this is hard work, but you don't want to talk about anything, they give me one-word answers, you know, you're kind of like sweating bullets, and this is really uncomfortable. You know, I knew you grew up in South Dakota on a farm. Tell me about that. What was it like to be a young girl and the early 1900s on a farm? And all of a sudden, these eyes start to sparkle, and they start telling you what it was like to be on the farm, and they start telling stories of their youth, you know? I gotta tell you here, and I told this at one of the classes that Dorothy taught, one of the things one of our hospice befrienders did is, a hospice befriender is assigned to one person, and he or she visits that person until they die. And then continue to visit the family to do follow-up and grief work with them. And this hospice befriender would go and she'd say, you know, you have such a neat story, but do you mind if I write it down? And so every week she'd go to, you know, start at the beginning, and she'd tell the story and she'd write it down. And then she'd go home and she'd type it on a little computer, and then she'd go back the next week and take down the next chapter. And she did this week after week after week till she got the patient's full story. And before this hospice patient died, this wonderful befriender, kind of on her desktop publisher, or whatever you do, published this little book, gave it to the patient and to all the patient's spouse and their kids. Now, what a beautiful thing to do for somebody. Somebody said, what do you do with, somebody was talking about AIDS patients in Dorothy's class, and I said, everybody wants to be known. You know, especially if you're going to die young. Say you're visiting as a hospice volunteer an AIDS patient, and they're dying at 27, and you haven't done everything you wanted to do and said everything you wanted to say. But to know that it's written down, and not just my perspective of your life, but you tell me what you want written down, and I'll write it down so I know that I'm saying exactly what you want your loved ones to hear. So there's, how did I get on that? I have no idea, but you know, a way to get people to talk. I guess that's what I'm talking about, and reminiscing and telling stories. Okay, what else? See, I told you I'd start to talk if you didn't, so. Anything else? I'm sorry you weren't here. We were telling stories of, we imagined being old, having a chronic illness. Sorry you missed that.
Probably one of the things I've seen with people I've both visited and things that happened with me is that you want to get your anger out first, and then after your anger's out, you can start really talking to people after you get your anger out.
After you get that anger out, you can go on from there.
Go on from there.
I am going to talk because I just realized what time it was, and now I'm really going to have to talk fast. Okay. What makes a successful visit? One of the things it does, and I realized after I put this up here that you can't read it, so I'm going to read you the significant stuff from here. But Ann Landers, as you see here, this girl was 10 years old, her mother died, and for 37 years she wasn't really allowed to mourn her mother's death. She said, "I was feeling very sad. My father told me if I couldn't put a smile on my face," this is 2 weeks after mom's death for this 10-year-old, "if I couldn't put a smile on my face, he'd find me another place to live. I was never to cry or express my grief to anyone." So for 37 years, she didn't express the grief of her mother. She said, "I didn't need standard cliches. What I did need was someone to talk to, someone to cry with, someone to scream at. And most of all, I needed someone to just hold me. After all, aren't these the basic needs of all hurting people?" The bottom, grief is unexpressed, and suppressed grief is a time bomb. If you don't express your grief, sometime, at some point in time, it's going to come out, and it's going to come out in a way that is probably inappropriate. Grief definitely is like that. She knew what she needed, and what she needed was to be the one who does the actions. In that whole scenario, she was the one who was going to cry, she was the one who was going to scream, she wanted to be able to cry. And the person who she wanted with her was more of the passive person. Now I say passive kind of with tongue in cheek, because if we're a listener, we're only really on the outside looking passive. Because what are we doing if we're the listener? We're listening, we're getting good eye contact, we're nodding at the appropriate places to show that we're indeed listening. Perhaps we're handing a tissue. Perhaps we're formulating a question to help them keep moving on whatever it is that they're talking about. Perhaps we're parroting back what we've heard them say. What we are not doing is we are not giving advice. Better for worse, this is probably the worst overhead I've ever used, all these cracks. People don't want advice. Let me read this one to you. "April's really wearing me out these days, Connie. She wants to be mobile so badly. All she wants me to do is hang on to my hands and walk. She's irritable. If I leave her, she screams. She hardly naps. Now I can't seem to get anything done." Then her friend, who wasn't asked for advice, says, You just need to be firm, Al. Just tell her that you've got things to do, and then put her in her playpen and go away." And she's thinking, spoken like a friend who doesn't have a baby. She didn't want her friend's advice. She just wanted to be able to air her anger, her frustration, tell her story, and have what would have been a better response for her friend?
"Oh, that must be hard,
Al." Yeah. She just wanted somebody to say, "I hear your pain, I hear your story, I hear your frustration, I've been there." We had a befriender, wonderful befriender, older gentleman, maybe about 70 years old, and one day we sent him up to do his visits. These cards we give him, we sent him up, and he said that. And then they come down after their visits, and they write these visits up, and then I read what they wrote, and we talk about it. We call it debriefing, because we know that sometimes the experiences you have up on the floors of the hospital can be really kind of overwhelming, and we want people to be able to leave these experiences in the hospital rather than to take them home and not have talked about them. Plus the fact that we need to know who we need to go back and do follow-up calls on. So John made this hospital call. He went in, did a card, got a card, went to this visit to this patient's room, and this patient that he went to see had a very thick accent. And John said, "Guys, God is kind of what he did for a living and what his family was like and that sort of stuff." And then this man just took off speaking. And with this thick accent, for 25 minutes, he talked. And John said to me, "And Jeannie, I only got a word here and a word there." I said, "For 25 minutes? And he goes, "Yeah, I had no idea what he was talking about." But listen to what he said at the end of the visit. After 25 minutes, he kind of went, and then he said, "It's so nice to have a friend like you. Please come back and see me, and thank you so much for coming." I said, "John," he had no idea that you couldn't understand. I said, "What did you do to keep this conversation going?" He said, "I just looked at him, and I kept nodding, and then I smiled," and he said, "That's what I did." Sometimes we don't even need
genuinely believes we care. And that is just a great example. Henry Nouwen, for some of you, you may want to read his book called Reaching Out, but I believe that he is one of the best educators on how to do a sensitive visit and how to be a friend to someone through any crisis. A friend, listen to the verbs, a friend who can be silent with us in a moment of despair or confusion, who can stay with us in an hour of grief and bereavement, who can tolerate not knowing, not curing, not healing, and face with us the reality of our powerlessness. That is a friend who cares. Silence. Sometimes it's just like John Hatch. We're silent, but we're there. We're staying. We're tolerating, not being the curers of this, but being the carers. The medical people can cure. The psychologists can cure. But we're just there to care. So they're words not of action, but they're words of presence. And that's our goal. I don't know about you, but this has never been a particularly meaningful statement to me. Blessed are those who mourn. I mean, I like the Beatitudes, they're really nice, but that doesn't say anything to me. Well, one of the chaplains that I took my training from loves Greek and Hebrew. And he went back and looked up what this means in Greek. And it means this. Can you all see it? Fortunate are those who go through deep emotional hurt, for they shall have a called person alongside. Doesn't that have meat? I want to break that down. First of all, fortunate are those who go through deep emotional hurt. Deep emotional hurt is a whole lot bigger than those who mourn. Those who mourn, we think of someone dying. But this is all loss. All loss, no matter what it is. They shall have is a promise. God says it. I believe it. I'm going to claim that promise. If I'm going through something, I know that God can send me someone who's going to be there for me. The next thing is a called person. Oh, I really like that. A called person. And I really believe that a called person is any Christian. How many of you are baptized? You have been called. You have been called and you have been commissioned in your baptism. At that point, you became a child of God. At that point, you became one of His workers. How many of you participate in church? Okay, how many of you, at the end of perhaps a Lutheran service, maybe other services, what's the last thing that's said in the service?
So, go in peace.
Go in peace. What's the next line?
To love and serve the Lord.
To love and serve the Lord. Or in some churches, just serve the Lord. What is that? That is your weekly, weekly commissioning to go out and do Christ's work. So not only are we commissioned to baptism, but that we are blessed and sent out weekly to be those called people. That's a blessing. In our church, I belong to this rather large church, and in the bulletin every week, it lists pastors, and lists our five pastors, and it lists the staff, and lists our staff, and then at the bottom, ministers, dash, all the people of St. Paul Lutheran Church. None of us can get out of it when it's right there. called alongside. Talked about anger. If someone's going through the valley of the shadow of anger, do we want to pull them through real fast? Oh, God, you know, this is so uncomfortable when someone is angry. You know, but can we stick with them? When they're sharing their anger, can we just stay with them, even though it's really uncomfortable? Or maybe they're going through the valley of the shadow of tears, really crying. Do we say, oh, don't cry. Oh, God, no, please, don't say that. Hand them a tissue, cry with them. Allow them to express those feelings of sadness. The worst thing we can say is, don't cry.
How about if they're finally joyous? You know, it's been 3 months and finally the widower is willing to go out for dinner, or the widow is willing to go out for dinner, whatever. And if they're at that point of joy, do we want to go like the widow in the beginning and says, now I have some things on my agenda and I want to tell you about this, and finally they're joyful and we want to bring them back to the horribleness of their situation? No. If they're going through the joy side, we go right alongside of them. We're not pushing them through, we're not pulling them through. I think this poem says it beautifully in the verbs again that are here. I cannot ease your aching heart nor take the pain away, but let me stay with you and take your hand and walk with you today. Again, look at the verbs. I'll listen if you need to talk. I'll wipe away your tears. I'll share your worries when they come. I'll help you face your fears. I'm here. I'll stand by you, etc., etc. I'm not going to go into all of that. You're not alone. I'm still here. If I've heard anything, and I have copies of this poem if some of you would like it, if I've heard anything through the times I've worked as a grief counselor, I've heard, you know, after a while people don't want to hear your story anymore. They don't want to hear how much I miss Sam. And it's only been 6 months and I'm still in my grief. So we need somebody who's willing to say, I'll stick with you through this. I'll stick with you. And that's why sometimes it's good to have that person who isn't related, who isn't a family member, who isn't a church member, because I can tell somebody who's never heard the story before. The next thing I'm going to tell you, I think, is the most important thing I'm going to tell you all night. And if there's nothing else you take away from here, remember what I'm going to say now. A friend of mine was taking clinical pastoral education, which means she was going to be a student chaplain in a hospital. The day she started, she walked up to the veteran chaplain who'd been there for maybe 40 years, and she said, what's the most important thing I need to know as I start my chaplaincy work? In his 40 years of experience, he said to her, remember the experiences that you are called into are holy ground. Remember the experiences you are called into our holy ground. If we remember that the things that we are called to do are places that God is putting us, and that if we view them as sacred stories, and if we view them as holy ground, we're going to have those antennas up and be sensitive to what that person needs. People, when we get past the frivolous little talk at the top and they get down to their stories, and that's what I'm talking about, kind of level four talking. They're going to be talking about illness, they're going to be talking about death, they're going to be talking about grief and love and depression and dysfunctional family situations and suicide and faith and prayer, and this is that stuff that is the sacred stories that we are privileged to be a part of. Because people are sharing with us on an intimate level where they trust us with the most personal, caring, intimate parts of their lives. We become, at that point, the hands of Christ, and I believe this. When I first became a chaplain 8 years ago, my littlest son said, why in the world do you want to work with people who are sick, dying, or people who've had somebody die? I mean, he just couldn't get it. And one of the things that I said to him in explaining this, I said, you know, Jesus was only here for 33 years and then he left, and that was 2,000 years ago. And now he asks us to hold the hand of that dying person because he's not here to do it. And he asks us to hear the story of the woman who had the hemorrhage for 12 years because he's not here to do it. And that's what he asks of us. I'm going to tell you a quick story about Mr. Brown. I go to a staffing for all the cancer patients every morning at 8 o'clock, and the oncologist for that morning said, we got a real case this time. Mrs. Brown has cancer and it's really bad, and she sits in her hospital room crying, and her husband sits on the other side of the room laughing. And then his assistant said,
he's going to be absolutely no help to her whatsoever. It's the most ridiculous situation. I've just written them off. Chaplain, this is yours. Oh, great, you know. Anything they don't want to deal with, right? And so I went up later that afternoon to go visit Mrs. Brown, and I walked in the room. Now, I dress as a professional. I wear a suit, you know, and that sort of stuff, and a little name tag. And I walked in the room, and Mr. Brown was right there, and he looked at me and laughed. And I thought, you know, I don't look funny. And then I realized this was one of those people who, when they're uncomfortable, what do?
They laugh.
They laugh inappropriately because they don't know what else to do. Well, I introduced myself to Mr. Brown and went over and sat and tried to carry on pretty much of a conversation with Mrs. Brown, though including Mr. Brown. She was scared, didn't talk much. Finally, Mr. Brown started answering for her, you know, one of those situations, and so there was kind of a three-way conversation. And she said that she was going to be having surgery the next day. The next day, and I do believe by the guidance of the Holy Spirit, I happened to find him in the waiting room while she was in having her surgery. I walked to the waiting room, found him all alone. And I sat down and I started asking him about himself and what kind of job did he have to leave to be there. That got him on pretty much surface stuff. And then I said, tell me about your wife. So we started talking. And he talked about how he married her when she was 15 years old, just a child. He said, you know, she was a kid, and I was so much older. And he said, I guess it sort of started out that I was taking care of her. And then we had children, and she didn't even know how to handle children because she was a child herself, so I brought her mother in. So we kind of, he went on to tell the story. He said, you know, I've done everything for her. He said, I know I probably shouldn't have, but I've been her caregiver, and she's been dependent on me, and I've kind of handled everything. And I could tell the conversation was getting harder for him. And then he got a lump in his throat and he said to me, you know, this is the only thing in her life that I can't fix for her. I can't take and fix this. I can't go through this for her. I can't help her do it. She's got to do it on her own, and she's never done anything like this before. And in the middle of this huge room of people, he started to cry. And then he said to me, I don't ever talk to anybody. He said, I can't believe I'm telling you all this. I don't talk to anybody. And then he went on with the story. Beautiful. And then he said again about 10 minutes later, I don't know why I'm talking to you. And he kept going. We had a couple more conversations like that as her cancer got worse. And she eventually died of her cancer. And the day he died, she died, he asked me to come in and do prayers around the bedside. And then he walked over to me and he said, we don't have a church, you know. I said, I know. He said, I want you to do my wife's funeral for me. I hate doing funerals. I mean, I have to admit it, I absolutely hate it. But I knew that I was the only one who could do this funeral for him because he had trusted me with his life and with his feelings. And so I went to the visitation and met his other children and daughter-in-laws and so on, grandchildren. And a son and a daughter-in-law walked up to me on two different occasions and said to me, I know that my dad trusts you. And I want you to know that when he told you that he doesn't talk to anybody, he really doesn't. He told you things that he has never, ever told us. Thanks for doing what you did for my father and for my mother. I am not telling you this because I'm an exceptional chaplain. I was at the right place at the right time. And I had time. The doctor didn't have time. He has 100 patients. The nurses don't have time. They have 20 patients. The dietitian didn't have time. They didn't have a minister. But I had time. And I didn't do anything special except listen to him genuinely. And he knew that what he was saying to me was being held in confidence and he knew he could trust me. That's holy ground, folks, and those are sacred, sacred stories. Maybe I don't have time for anymore. I don't. Because we started late, I will just open this up to see if there are any other questions. I have other stuff. I'm obviously not going to do that. Before I ask if there's any questions, I just want to say this. I don't know what you do back home, but I would ask that you remember that you are commissioned at your baptism, that you are blessed and commissioned every week, and that you have the skills to go out and be Christ's people, reaching out to those in need. Sometimes it's going to be at a bus stop. Sometimes it's going to be a short conversation in the line of the grocery store. But know that you are blessed to be these special listeners of Christ. Anything else before the bell rings for chapel? Those of you who need to leave for chapel, go. If there's anybody else who wants to interact, talk, ask a question, please do.
One of the problems I'm having is the dealing with I want to die and why doesn't God take me?
Mm.
I feel like I agree. And so how do I can't say that. But I don't understand why God isn't taking me either. Mm-hmm. You know, so where do we go with that one?
How often does it come up?
It's pretty constantly coming.
You know, I don't think I know, because with everybody it's different. And some people are wanting to die because they're in so much pain. We have, of course, living wills and durable power of attorney for health care, where you can make sure you sign on the dotted line. If I get sick, for goodness sakes, don't give me penicillin. Don't resuscitate me. Don't do that. That's one of the things
she's done a lot.
But she's not sick. She's just kind of living without any goal. You know, that's really hard, not knowing the person. Sometimes, if the person is a Christian, you ask them, would you mind doing something for me? Would you mind praying for these people? You know, you give them something that they can do. I know there's some older people who are homebound, feel like, I used to serve the church, I was in the ladies' aid, I did this, this, and this, but I can still use a phone. So that they have a purpose. You know, she could still do phoning for the church. And all of a sudden she felt significant and important again. I guess finding something that makes them feel like, even though you're old and you've got two broken hips and, you know, whatever, we still think that you have worth as a human being. You can do these jobs. And I guess just loving that person, saying, you know, God, you know, you haven't died yet, but I'm so glad you're here, because I really need you, and I just love coming to visit you, and I need to hear more of your stories or whatever.
Yeah.
I don't know. Somebody else? Yeah.
In the beginning of your presentation tonight, you listed out several significant things that people should think about: listening, eye contact, nodding, smiling. We're not sure I got all these things.
Handing them a tissue, touching their hand. You know.
So fast I couldn't remember.
What? Nonverbals that ask, parroting back, reframing a question, thinking of a question that helps them continue talking.
Mm-hmm. A couple of years ago, when I was visiting a man who had first lost his ability to walk because of some difficulties in his legs, then lost his sight, and when last time I saw him before he died, his hearing was pretty minimal. And so I wasn't even sure that he could hear my responses. But anyway, he was saying, I'm ready to die. I don't know why God hasn't taken me yet. I've been ready for, you know, 5-6 years, it's just too long to wait. I couldn't honestly say that, you know, I'm glad you're still here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll miss, I'm glad that God is.